Every night before he went to bed, former President Eisenhower would brush his teeth in front of the mirror in the bathroom. This is what I call the mirror test. He would, as he was brushing his teeth, he would ask himself, did I do the best I could do today? And if you're honest, the answer is not always yes. You know, we cut corners, we take shortcuts, and, you know, we half-ass things. But if you're being honest with yourself and the answer is not yes, then you will take it one step further and say, this is what I need to do, you know, to be better. Remember my human orthopedic surgeon friend, Kevin Scully? Scully used to tell me, and I still stay in touch with him. He's retired now, but he used to tell me, he said, Whedon, you got to have a fighter pilot mentality to do this. You have to realize that if you get yourself in a difficult situation, you have to be able to extricate yourself. And you know, I mean, not everybody can do surgery. It's kind of like flying a plane. You know, it's not easy. Not everyone can do it. If it were easy, anyone could do it. And Scully's right. You know, you have to be a competent surgeon, you have to have a fighter pilot mentality and say, I can get through this. When she said he was positive, I think I uttered something that's probably not suitable for this podcast.
No, it is.
I think I said, fuck me blind. And our associate across the room heard me and looked at me, mouthed, because I was on the phone, positive.
Welcome back to another episode of Irreplaceable Truths. I'm Dr. G, and I'll try to do this without getting teary-eyed. I actually have my original mentor on with me. This was the guy that bet the manager a cold beer that I wouldn't last more than 5 days in his practice. And next thing he knows, 5 years later, he's actually moving me to the University of Illinois, driving the U-Haul. This is the guy that promised I would get into Purdue no problem. And that was the first rejection letter I got. Everyone loves to have a good mentor, and a mentor is more than just someone who teaches you. There's someone who coaches you. There's someone who's a father figure, mother figure. There's someone who opens you up to their network. It's someone who's always there, available to talk whenever you need to, and also available to give you a swift kick in the rear if you ever need one. This guy has been amazing. He is not only a veterinarian, he also has his master's in public health from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He is now, he should be retired, but he loves what he's doing so much. He's doing high spay neuter down in Florida, on the west coast of Florida. I would love to welcome Dr. Bob Whedon to the show with me. Bob, how are you doing, sir?
Well, thank you for all those platitudes. I guess should I refer to you as Dr. G, as Gershon, as G, as, you know, we have a little pet name that I probably can't use since this is being recorded.
No, you certainly can. Go ahead and use it.
Well,
be your authentic self, Bob.
My initials are GRW, so you always used to call me Giardia. And yep. Since your sort of nickname was Gersh and it sort of rhymed with douche, I would refer to you as douche. So sorry, folks, if you find this offensive, but that's the way it is.
And 30 years later, 34 years later, that's still how we talk to each other. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it is.
And a matter of fact, my RVT, who is now my partner in this business that we do here, she actually got an earful from you too when we were trying to play this. So
is that Mallory?
That's Mallory. Yeah, that sure is Mallory.
I got that text message.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. So you know the one thing, Bob. The one thing I never really clearly got from you was what drew you to veterinary medicine?
Well, you know, I always liked science when I was in high school and medicine. And medicine is an applied form of science. I grew up with horses. And so veterinary medicine seemed like a logical choice to combine all that. I showed Hunters and Jumpers as a kid, and had a thoroughbred that I'd gotten off the track. This was in 71 or maybe 72. I was at a horse show in Lexington, Kentucky. And when she landed after going over a jump, she fractured a sesamoid bone in her left front fetlock. Back then, you know, the old adage, they shoot horses, don't they? You know, that break bones. But there was an equine orthopedic surgeon in Paris, Kentucky, that actually screwed that fractured sesamoid back together. And she went on to compete again after that. And to me, that was just the coolest thing. And I knew that I wanted to become an equine orthopedic surgeon. And that's what I set my sights on.
Yeah. Equine orthopedic surgeon. You ended up. As we all know, that didn't quite happen.
Well, do you want me to go on with the story? I got into veterinary school, actually, just in the interest of transparency, Purdue was the first rejection letter I got the first time I applied. So, but I eventually got in, and I went in just knowing I was going to be an equine orthopedic surgeon, but you've heard the old adage, you know, a chance to cut's a chance to cure. And so I love surgery, and I learned very quickly when I was in veterinary school that the level of sophistication was so much greater in small animal than it was in equine. And so I, you know, transitioned over, to small animal surgery, because you could just do so much more. Then I discovered the importance of animal population control. And that's when I realized that's what I was meant to do. It involved surgery, and, I could help, the community. And I mean, why play golf when you can spay cats, right?
Yeah, that's a quote you're famous for saying. That is definitely a quote you're famous for saying. You're also very famous for throwing car molts when you're trying to repair ACLs back in the days before TPLO was so popular. I had to dodge a few of those because this one's fucking dull. This one's fucking dull. Chom, chom! I remember those days too. When you were in Wilmington, how did that build your philosophy of serving community?
Well, I was a veterinarian on the County Board of Health, and that oversaw animal control. And at the time, they were adopting out intact animals with a voucher for $50 off the cost of sterilization at the veterinarian of the adopter's choice. And a subsequent review revealed that only 50% of those vouchers were redeemed, which meant that not all of these animals were being sterilized. And it kind of dawned on me, there's an old adage from the 70s. If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And, I realized we were part of the problem. We were adopting out animals that were able to reproduce and then subsequently contributing to the population and animal control. And I realized that that we were indeed part of the problem. And so I was part of a team that built an on-site spay-neuter facility at Animal Control. And that's kind of what set me on the course for embracing animal population control as my professional passion.
Who mentored you in your early days? I never even found that one out either.
Well, I thought a lot about that question, Gersh, because the first job I had a really great mentor. He would give me just enough rope that I could almost hang myself, and then he would, extricate me from whatever situation I got in. And I ended up buying his practice, and he retired. But then, you know, I ended up in Wilmington. My first ex-wife was transferred down there, and I, my mentor down there, you know, mentoring goes both ways, Gersh, both good and bad. And this guy was bad. I mean, really bad. When I first moved to Wilmington, he was the antithesis of what I wanted to be as a veterinarian. And so it showed me how I did not want to practice veterinary medicine. And so from that standpoint, you know, having a bad mentor helped set me on a course to, you know, to where I wanted to be.
Yeah, because, well, I've said on all my episodes, you know, you and Dr. Lanzi were my second and third father. You were always there to talk. You were always there when I needed you. You know, and the one thing you taught me, which was so important, is you taught me the importance of soft skills in veterinary medicine, how to talk to clients, how to treat the staff, how to run a business, how to have balance, how you prepared me more for veterinary medicine than vet school ever could come close to. I mean, yeah, vet school is the textbook knowledge stuff, but you had already taught me so much of that, that by the time I got to school, I was already leaps and bounds ahead of most of my classmates. And those are the types of things that are so important. And I think one of the biggest reasons a lot of these, well, you know, with my academic research I'm doing now, that's mentorship is probably one of the biggest reasons why a lot of these veterinarians are having so much trouble. And what I love about your story is that when you quit veterinary school, you could have retired and just run off and been a legacy, but you decided to go to the University of Illinois and become a professor. How were those days? Well, did you enjoy working with the students?
Oh, I loved it. That was, you know, that was as much fun as I had, you know, starting and building, you know, College Road Animal Hospital in Wilmington. Private practice for me, you know, I reached a point where I just didn't feel like I was being challenged. And, you know, did you ever see the movie Up Close and Personal with Robert Redford, Michelle Pfeiffer?
Just about that. You used this quote with me when we went to a Purdue football game while I was in vet school.
Yeah.
By the way.
You know, and you know, here he'd been at the pinnacle of the profession and was now a station manager that was mentoring a young and up and coming reporter. And they got involved, and over a bottle of wine one night, she asked him, how could you leave the pinnacle of our profession? And Robert Redford thought about it for a moment and said, it wasn't fun anymore. And I felt that way in private practice. That's why I went back to school and got my master's, because I wanted to focus on a broader segment of the population. And you know, I found numerous times during my practice career, you know, I love surgery. You know, you recall when we worked together, yep, that I love surgery. But there came a time when it just wasn't the same. It just wasn't a challenge. And so, you know, I went and spent a week with Bill Blevins at Purdue doing a practitioner sabbatical. I learned how to do diagnostic ultrasound, and, you know, took a couple of other courses and really became proficient with ultrasound in our practice. And it was a great practice builder and allowed us to improve our standard of care. I also was kind of intrigued by diagnostic cytology. So, you know, I spent a fellowship with Denny DiNicola at Purdue, doing diagnostic cytology like 3 years in a row.
I remember that. That was while I was working with you.
The last year I was there, on the first day, he handed me a box of 100 lymph node aspirates, and I had to determine which ones were lymphoma and which ones were reactive hyperplasia. By the end of the week, I was able to do that. So this was a new challenge, and it kind of reinvigorated my desire to practice. But over time, you know, once I got my master's and saw the value of, you know, population medicine, that coupled with the fact that, you know, I had this burgeoning desire to address animal overpopulation, you know, it became apparent to me that you know, that was the direction I needed to go. And when I went to Illinois, I was able to train students in high quality, high volume spay neuter and make them more efficient and proficient. And you know, a student who's proficient at spaying a dog, because tissue handling is tissue handling, is likely very proficient at removing a bladder stone, doing an enterotomy for an intestinal foreign body, doing a splenectomy. And so my goal was to get these students a minimum of 50 solo surgeries during the 2 weeks that I had them, and make them more proficient surgeons, which yeah, I love doing. And the only reason I left was mainly because, you know, I was just getting tired of the winters. I was starting to get old. And I thought, well, I'll move to Florida because my brother was living in Sebring at the time. And I thought, well, I'll be closer. He's, you know, the last living family I've got. So, you know, then I thought, I'll get down there and I'll play golf every day.
Yeah. Well, I remembered you thought you were a good golfer when we were in Wilmington. I spanked you a couple times doing that, too.
I don't recall that.
Well, that's because you're old and your memory's gone, but that's okay.
No, but I think maybe you're smoking something back there in the studio.
Yeah. Well, no. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. It's better than drinking. You got to remember, you're the one who taught me the three food groups in veterinary medicine is caffeine, nicotine, and alcohol.
That's right. Alcohol, and nicotine, and caffeine.
Yeah, that was day four that I was working for you.
Did Mallory share with you my text response? she actually asked me a question.
I know she did. I told her to. Just so that people could get to know you. Because you had such, because people always ask me, you know, what is it about you that you were doing? And I have to be completely honest with you, Bob. I took your vision and your playbook and I instilled it into two veterinary practices here in California. And I was very, very successful. Not only was I successful monetarily, I was successful in the community. I was successful on health and genetics committees of different breeds. I was successful in getting 20 employees into vet school. Mentored them into vet school and a countless number of RVTs. I can't even tell you how many RVTs I mentored to get their license. And, you know, and then actually one of my RVTs then went and opened up an RVT school.
Oh, wow.
And so the thing is, I paid it forward what everything you had taught me. So I want to let you know that even though you don't think much about it, your legacy does live on in other people. And that's the sign of a solid mentor, is that I was so proud of what you taught me and how you taught me to be as a man, more importantly, as a veterinarian, that I was able to do that. So when it comes to my doctorate, you know, I was so pissed off at the time, I was going to compare corporate to private owned practices. And I'm like, why the hell would I even want to go that route? I don't want to give corporate any ideas, even though they do need to know how to do things better. But I sat back and thought, and I'm like, why are all 20 of my veterinarians that I got helped get into vet school still thriving, loving, and cheerleaders for the profession? So I thought back to what you taught me, and that's how I came up with the study that I'm doing on early career veterinarians. Hmm. So I want you to know that, you know, you can be humble, which I don't know you to really be, but you can be humble here. That's fine. But I am going to blow smoke up your ass this entire interview because I think you deserve it.
And well, Gershon, you're nice to say that, but and you're embarrassing the hell out of me. And
which is perfect. Isn't that my job?
I know that this is, you know, this is part of your academic research. So let's get back to the questions.
No, I'm not studying senility. So after you get your master's in public health, you actually had a rabies case in 2006, didn't you? In Wilmington.
Yep. And what was really interesting about that at the time, I was doing a fellowship with the Southeast Public Health Leadership Institute, and my project was entitled Rabies Awareness and Community Education. And that Johnny actually came into our practice while I was at Chapel Hill. We had to be at Chapel Hill for three weekly sessions throughout the year. Yep. And then had to do remote stuff in between. And I was actually in Chapel Hill at the first weekly session of Southeast Public Health Leadership Institute when Johnny came in. And he was brought in by animal control. They thought he'd been hit by a car because he had a fractured radius and ulna, and with an open wound. And so my ex-wife was one of the veterinarians who was taking care of him, and we were changing his splint every couple of days and treating the open wound, and that was healing very nicely. And then one night, I was home, and this all happened right before Christmas. I think the week before Christmas. And so one of our associate veterinarians had changed his splint, that day, and that evening, one of the staff came to me and said that, you know, Johnny was acting agitated, and I thought maybe his splint was too tight. And so we, you know, changed the splint again. And then I was at home. The next day was a Thursday, and I was off, and the staff called me very early in the morning and said that Johnny was recumbent in his cage and having difficulty breathing. And my first thought was that, you know, he had aspirated because we sedated him a second time for the second splint change. And, you know, he hadn't been fasted. And so I told him to get some thoracic radiographs and that I would come in. And I got there, and so my ex-wife had him in an oxygen cage, and he was laying there. The x-rays were clean, no evidence of aspiration pneumonia. And he was starting to paddle. And I looked at her, and I asked her, "Have you considered rabies?" This was the beginning of the end of my marriage. she looked at me, Gersh, like I was a booger on the end of her finger. There hasn't been a case of canine rabies in New Hanover County in 50 years. Long story short, he continued to deteriorate, so we euthanized him. And I took his body out to animal control so they could send the head in. Now, this was, I think, the 21st of December, right before Christmas. And so Gene McNeil, the director of animal control, said, "I'm going to call the lab tomorrow just to, normally they don't call with a negative, but being that it's right before Christmas, I want to make sure that the ball didn't get dropped." So I went to work, the next day, Friday. We had, the way we did things at that time, we had kind of split crews, and from a doctor standpoint, you had every other Friday, Saturday, and Sunday off. And then Christmas Day was a Monday that year. So whoever had the weekend had the holiday responsibility as well. And so, you know, since we didn't have any kids, mercifully, you know, we took Christmas so the rest of the staff could,
Also Jewish. Let's throw that in there. throw that in there too.
See when
you are a tribe member. So, you know, the Christmas thing really doesn't.
So in any case, I was working that Friday and I'd just gotten there. It was early in the morning. I want to say like 8:30. And, there was one of the receptionists came back, said, Dr. McNeil's on the phone for you. And, you know, if you recall, Gersh, Thursday night used to be my drinking night. And, you know, we'd go to Hooters and eat chicken wings and drink beer. And I'd gone out with a group of friends and literally kind of forgotten all about this, you know. And then all of a sudden, man, I was awakened when the receptionist said, Dr. McNeil's on the phone. And I picked up the phone and I said, hey, girlfriend, give me some good news. And it's just silence. She said he was positive.
Wow.
And that, you know, there are a few moments in my life that I vividly remember. And I remember one of our associates was across the treatment room. And I said, when she said he was positive, I think I uttered something that's probably not suitable for this podcast.
No, it is. You could say, but, exactly, because fuck is a medical term.
I think I said, fuck me blind. And our associate across the room heard me and looked at me and mouth, because I was on the phone, positive. And I'm like shaking my head. And that was such a surreal thing, Gersh, because we went into crisis mode. Right. You know, we had to identify everyone in all caps that had contact with that puppy so that they could receive assessment for post-exposure prophylaxis. And in the end, 50 people were deemed to have been exposed. Not that he bit anybody, but, you know, as you well know, there are three modes of rabies transmission: a bite that breaks the skin, salivary contact of a fresh open wound, salivary contact with mucous membranes. What do puppies do?
They kiss
your face. Your face and kiss you. And right. The people who'd come to see this puppy to potentially adopt him, 50 people were deemed to have been exposed, and the cost was over $400,000. And both our liability and workman's comp insurers dropped us after that. You know, I don't know what would have happened, had we missed the diagnosis. I've thought about this a lot, and I'm concerned that if 50 people were deemed to have been exposed, somebody would have come down with rabies. And, you know, you talk about, you know, leadership in a crisis situation. My former partner really did not want to publicize this because he was really concerned about bad PR for the practice. And I argued, no. We have to get this out there. We have to make sure anybody who had contact with this puppy gets assessed for post-exposure prophylaxis. And, you know, I mean, talk about bringing the wackos out of the woodwork. I mean, one lady called and I remember we were forwarding after hours calls to my home in case somebody saw the news story. And one lady said, I was in your office last week. Did I get exposed? And I was like, well, ma'am, did you handle or get kissed by a little puppy with a splint on its leg? No. So you're good to go. Yeah. We had all these, you know, but the important thing was that 50 people did receive post-exposure prophylaxis.
And well, that's where leadership comes in, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, we had no choice but to do the right thing. I mean, I learned in high school that, you know, the true test of a person's character is knowing that they will do the right thing with or without supervision. And we had to do the right thing. And the right thing in this case was to get the word out so that anybody who was potentially exposed could receive post-exposure prophylaxis.
Unbelievable. Well, that's integrity. And that's one of the huge, you know, when you look at your professional identity, that needs to be one of the biggest ones. That's got to be towards the top, is that when people are not watching, are you still going to do the right thing?
And you know, that brings up a good point, because, you know, I tried to instill this in my students when I was in Illinois. You know, integrity is my North Star. And you know, we used to play a game with the students where we were riding to a rural shelter. You know, we had a mobile sterilization unit. It was a gooseneck, and the students would be with me in the pickup truck. And you know, I'd have them list the personality traits of a successful veterinarian. And they came up with some good ones. You know, being a lifelong learner, being a good communicator, being empathetic, you know, being a hard worker, all these things, yes, they're important. But rarely did anybody suggest integrity. And I remember I said, okay, you're getting a lot of them, but the one most important in my mind is integrity. And I had a student say, oh, wait, you know, we're veterinarians. We have integrity. Well, as Lee Corso would say, not so fast, because there are stories out there of veterinarians who don't act with integrity. And you have to make integrity part of who you are and what guides you. You're not just magically born with it. You have to practice it. You know, every night before he went to bed, former President Eisenhower would brush his teeth in front of the mirror in the bathroom. And this is what I call the mirror test. You know, he would, as he's brushing his teeth, he would ask himself, did I do the best I could do today? And if you're honest, the answer is not always yes. You know, we cut corners, we take shortcuts, and, you know, we half-ass things. But if you're being honest with yourself and the answer is not yes, then you will take it one step further and say, this is what I need to do, you know, to be better. And, you know, being honest with yourself is certainly, if, you know, it's like, what is it from the Shakespeare said from Hamlet, this above all, to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night, the day, thou canst not then be false to any man. If you can't be honest with yourself, how can you be honest with anyone?
When did you start going so deep? Because this is nothing I remember over 10 cent wings and 25 cent schooners.
Well, you know, I don't know. It's I just, you know, I've thought a lot about, you know, now that the end is closer than the start, and you know, you start thinking about your life and your legacy and what drives you, and you know, why anybody would play golf when they could spay cats.
So you were playing with the whole concept of One Health before it really became, you know, a big thing. Mm-hmm. What were some of the things that you were doing with One Health? Weren't you working on oral contraception for animals?
Well, yeah, not necessarily oral, non-surgical. I'm right. As a matter of fact, I'm still on the board of directors of the Alliance for Contraception in Cats and Dogs. And there are a couple of products, one of which is actually going through early FDA regulatory approval. So I suspect that we will have an FDA-approved non-surgical sterilant within the next 5 years. And that'll be a game changer for animal population control. I mean, consider feral cats. And that's the group, I think, in the United States anyway. In developing countries where they have street dog populations, maybe that group will be important there. But in the United States, we don't have a street dog problem, but we do have a feral cat problem. And, you know, if I'm doing a feral cat clinic, say on a Saturday, and, you know, they trap 50 cats, that's about the maximum number I can sterilize in a day. You know, if we have two veterinarians, maybe we could do 100. But imagine what we could do is if all we had to do was give them an injection. You know, we could do 500 cats. And you know, cats are that's interesting because, you know, cats are they're vilified for a number of reasons. And
bird population is the biggest one, right?
Well, and you know, that all that's based on a paper that was published like 40 years ago that it has been flawed and biased. And you know, my friend Peter Wolf, he and I, we just actually wrote an article in the journal Shelter Medicine and Community Animal Health. Entitled An Inconvenient Truth, Targeted TNR Enjoys a Track Record Unmatched by Lethal Means for Managing Free-Roaming Cats. And we say in there, and we present a lot of evidence in this article, says, as the evidence presented here makes clear, efforts to manage free-roaming cat populations using lethal methods are often misguided and counterproductive, as are efforts to undermine TNVR programs. However inconvenient, it is nevertheless true, unquote. And so cats are vilified. And the latest thing I've heard, Peter Mara, bastard, in his book, Cat Wars, The Devastating Consequences of a Cuddly Killer, you know, he cites toxoplasmosis. He says, oh, you know, this disease, you know, people get it, it gets in their brain and causes schizophrenia and cats are out there spreading it, you know, in the wild, and the sea lions in California are getting it because of the cats. Well, here's the thing that he doesn't say, and he should, and I'm going to say it. TNVR helps prevent the spread of toxoplasmosis. And here's why. Cats become exposed to toxoplasmosis when they first start hunting and kill a rodent that has it, and then the cat's the definitive host. So if these kittens are never born, they're not going to contract it, and they're not going to shed it in their stool. But here's the thing about shedding in the stool.
As soon as it hits the air, cats, they die.
Huh?
As soon as it hits the air, I thought they were dead, the toxins.
No, it actually... When the oocyst is shed in the cat feces, it's not infectious for a couple of days. It has to go through some life cycle changes. But here's the thing. Cats only shed the organism for a short period of time, anywhere from 1 to 3 weeks, once in their life. Cats don't, after they're done shedding, they don't shed again. And so again, by preventing these young cats from ever being born, that helps reduce the spread of toxoplasmosis. And so, you know, this is, if you look at TNVR programs from a One Health perspective, you know, we're preventing reproduction, which then helps reduce the incidence of toxoplasmosis. We're vaccinating these cats for rabies, which creates a barrier to the disease between wildlife and domestic pets and people. And so honestly, I can't think of anything that's more One Health oriented than trap, neuter, vaccinate, return programs.
Well, I remember when I was Amy and I were in vet school. We came down and we did a whole bunch of feral cats, and that was very rewarding. And we learned what we were doing. So let me get back to the medicine part. So you're doing these, spay neuters. Are you just doing ovariorectomies on these cats?
No, I do ovariohysterectomies.
Okay.
And the reason for that is, there are really two reasons, three reasons. It takes me between 4 and 6 minutes to spay a cat. So I use a very efficient process. And one of the things that makes it very efficient is to do what's called an ovarian pedicle tie, where you actually tie the ovarian pedicle onto itself. You don't put a ligature on. It's very quick, very safe. You can't do that if you're just doing ovariectomies, because you also have to put a ligature on the blood vessels that come to the ovary from the uterus.
Mm-hmm.
And so really, an ovariectomy is four ligatures, whereas an ovariohysterectomy is three, the two ovarian pedicles and the uterine body. There are veterinarians who swear by ovariectomy and say it's faster, smaller incision. I don't know how you can get any smaller than my incisions are anyway right now, but I can't argue with that. In my hands, ovariohysterectomy is what I do. And I think one of the other arguments is, by leaving the uterus, there is a potential for these cats to develop uterine neoplasia later on in life, although the incidence isn't great. But if you were to leave a little piece of ovary, so-called ovarian remnant syndrome, or if there is there's a piece of ovary that's not actually part of the ovary, and the cats start cycling, then they would be at risk for pyometra. So for me,
I had one cat in 28 years that had a pyo. One. How many have you had?
Yeah. Well, how many cats have you sterilized in 28 years?
Yeah. Well, that's true. But the thing is,
seriously, do you have an idea how many?
Well, I have no clue, dude.
Yes.
No.
Take a wild guess.
You tell. You started me spaying cats in 1997. So, yeah. I mean, that one week alone, I think I did 25. Okay. I mean, you keep going from there. But the one thing I you always taught me that all bleeding stops eventually. That's what you told me.
It does.
Have you ever seen a cat bleed out from a stump?
Yes.
You have?
I have.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I have not. Because I think once you crush that ovarian pedicle, I think from the uterine.
I've never seen one bleed out from an ovarian pedicle.
It's the uterine.
I've seen one bleed out from the uterine pedicle.
Yes.
And usually they're pregnant cats that have really, really large vessels.
Right.
And, if you...
Which are easier to see, just so everyone listening understands.
They are.
I like doing it when they're in heat or pregnant, because you see those vessels, especially if the dog is 160 pounds and should be only 100 pounds. You see those vessels a lot better.
Oh, I agree. A lot of veterinarians, most veterinarians, I would wager, they don't like doing in heat or pregnant animals. But for the reasons you've mentioned, I totally agree. It makes it much easier to identify the vessels. But if you don't get, you have to be careful when you're putting a ligature on the uterine body, because if you crank it too tight, you can actually cut through, that tissue. Because if they're pregnant or, postpartum, that tissue is friable, and you can cut through it. If you don't get it as tight as possible, you may occlude the vessels, but they can still bleed from the endometrial area of the stump. And the last thing, and I've knock on wood, I've never personally seen this, but I've read about it, is uterine artery erosion syndrome, where, you know, the ligature just kind of erodes the wall of the artery and they spontaneously start bleeding.
I had one of those when I was at Illinois on emergency.
Yeah.
I had one and it was, yeah. It was crazy.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess to finalize this discussion in my hands, you know, one of the things I may have taught you, I certainly taught my students, you do what you are most comfortable with,
right.
You know, and just because something is proposed in the literature as being the latest and greatest, if, you know, perfection is the worst enemy of good. And if you're good at what you do and you're comfortable in your hands doing it, why change? And unless there's just a demonstrable benefit to using a new technique. You know, if somebody published a paper that showed that doing ovariectomy alone increased the life expectancy of cats, you know, by 10 years or something, then I might consider doing it. But for me, in my hands, ovariohysterectomy, I mean, I've done 100,000 of them, you know, so it's muscle memory.
Yeah, it always is muscle memory. And, yeah. You know, even once after you do two of them or three of them, you get used to the fact that the skin's going to bleed. The stomach wall will bleed, even if you're a little bit off the linea. There are things that you do learn.
And oh, yeah.
I do remember sitting in surgery and going, hey, Bob, what is that? And you're like, I have no idea, but I just don't touch it. I avoid it. You know, but you also did teach me that, you know, and then, you know, my other mentor I had here, Dr. Hamill, you know, you both would have gotten along great because you both were under, I always, Dr. Hamill at least admitted it to me that the Lord doesn't like a coward, but I always felt as if that's how you practiced as well.
Well, I have a similar version that's, I would guess, what's the word I'm looking for? I can't think of it right now, but the non-religious version. Do you remember my human orthopedic surgeon friend, Kevin Scully?
Yep.
So Scully used to tell me, and I still stay in touch with him. He's retired now, but he used to tell me, he said, Whedon, you got to have a fighter pilot mentality to do this. You have to realize that if you get yourself in a difficult situation, you have to be able to extricate yourself. And you know, I mean, not everybody can do surgery. It's kind of like flying a plane. You know, it's not easy. Not everyone can do it. If it were easy, anyone could do it. And Scully's right. You know, you have to be a competent surgeon, you have to have a fighter pilot mentality and say, I can get through this.
Speaking of flying planes, did you ever get your pilot's license?
Yeah, I did, what? But I'm not current. I haven't flown in 25 years.
Do you remember the time I was going in on a Sunday to do all the technical and kennel stuff, and I set the alarm off, and you chewed my ass out because you had to land the fucking plane?
No, I don't remember that.
Yeah, of course you don't, but I do. That's what a good mentor does. He, like I said, he kicks you in the ass when you need it.
Well, that, you know, my days of flying were very limited because flying in Wilmington, you know, that was Class Delta airspace. You know, they had maybe three or four commercial flights and I don't know however many, you know, general aviation flights. But it's when I got into the more complex airspace like Raleigh and Charlotte and, you know, people are talking, you know, giving you directions, telling you what to do, what not to do. And it became sensory overload. And I thought, you know, I'd rather just sit up front and drink a beer than didn't have to actually fly the thing. So I haven't flown in 25 years and have no desire to do it now.
Well, at least you never crashed a plane.
At least what?
You never crashed a plane.
Oh, actually, I did.
I knew you did. That's why I said
Very,
that.
very early in my career. And here's the thing, Gersh. I lived because I didn't do what I was supposed to do. If I had done what I was supposed to do, the plane would have gone in straight like that and I'd be dead. But because I didn't do what I was supposed to do, it dropped straight down and broke the struts and struck the prop strike and whatnot. But I lived. I walked away from it. And that's kind of when I started thinking, you know, maybe God didn't intend for me to be a pilot.
Is there a story or is there a time you remember that still sticks with you that when you talk to a student or a young veterinarian?
Yeah, I was thinking about that, and this is hard because it dredges up some painful memories. We had a young associate veterinarian who just started, and he set up the anesthesia machine incorrectly, and which resulted in the death of a patient due to barotrauma. He asked me, "What are we going to tell the owner?" Without hesitation, I said, "We're going to tell him the truth." This was doubly painful for me, Gersh, because not only had we lost a patient in an accident that could have, should have been prevented, but to see this associate's true self was even more devastating. You know, what are we going to tell the owner? Well, we're going to tell him the truth. You know, remember what I said earlier about doing the right thing with or without supervision. And you know, I felt this young associate had a lot of potential for leadership in our practice. That was all in caps lost at that moment.
Well, did you at least walk him through what to tell the owner, or did you just like, were you like, just man up and you got to pick up the phone and just, I'm pretty sure you already felt like you got stabbed in the heart, you know, as soon as the patient passed.
Yeah,
But
I think in that instance I ended up talking to the owner, because I was one of the practice owners, and there's one of my favorite saying is, when something goes wrong, even if it's not your fault, it's still your problem, and I had to own it. And funny thing, it was a UNCW student, nice young lady, cute little puppy, you know, would have been a great client. Her father was an attorney in Raleigh, and I talked to him. He called the next day, and I told him precisely what happened. And I said, the good news, I said, the bad news is, you know, your daughter lost her pet. The good news is the pet didn't suffer because it was under anesthesia. And the even better news is we've taken steps to mitigate what happened so that it never happens again. And the guy, Gersh, he was an attorney, so I was expecting a battle. But he was like, you know, he said, Dr. Whedon, he said, I appreciate your honesty. He said, I had every intention of suing you, but after talking to you, I'm not going to. You'll understand if my daughter never sets foot in your practice again. And my response to that was, yes, sir, I understand that and I respect that. You know, it makes me sad because I think, you know, we practice the best medicine in town. But I also think that in that circumstance, I wouldn't be able to set foot in that door either. And so we never got sued, and it was all, you know, because, you know, I owned it. And
you were a mentor again. You were a mentor, you know, at that point. Did you ever have any students or associates come up to you that they were like, I'm done. This is, I can't. And how did you talk them off of that ledge?
You know, one of the great things about a DVM degree is that there are so many things you can do with it. I mean, look at my career. I started out in private practice, kind of focused on surgery, got into ultrasound, got into diagnostic cytology, got into population medicine, got a set, you know, another advanced degree, went on the faculty training students in high quality, high volume spay neuter. And there are other things I could have done. I could have gone into industry. I could have gone into governmental work. There's so many things you can do with a DVM degree. And, you know, like we talked about in the movie Up Close and Personal, you know, when something becomes not fun anymore, it's usually because things have gotten really, you know, mundane and boring and there's no challenge. And at least for me, you know, having a challenge in my work is important. It gives me, you know, a reason for being. And, you know, I think that, I think that if I had a student or a veterinarian come to me and express concerns about, you know, potentially leaving the profession, I would talk to them and say, you know, have you thought about using your degree for something else? You know, not leaving the profession, but doing something different within the profession.
You don't have to be in clinics to be a veterinarian.
No, not at all.
And the clinics are not for everybody. I mean, it takes a lot. I mean, the biggest thing when I hear people say I'm going to vet school because I love animals and I hate people, and I'm like, dude,
that's the wrong reason.
Every single animal comes in with a two-legged checkbook. You know, it is. If anything, it's more dealing with people than it is dealing with animals.
Well, and remember what I said when we first started this interview. You know, you asked me what set me on a path to a career in veterinary medicine. I said I love science and I love medicine, and you know, veterinary medicine seemed to be a nice mix of that because I also happen to like animals. But I didn't go to vet school because I loved horses. You know, I went to veterinary school because I love science.
Right. And, you know, the funny thing is I love sports medicine and I was going to get into sports medicine, but I had a Dalmatian, and this Dalmatian, I mean, any single national holiday, that dog would get into trouble, whether it would be swallowing a fish hook on 4th of July or freaking out from the fireworks and getting hit by a car on 4th of July, or it was something happened on Memorial Day. I don't remember what it was, but I remember I brought her in because she was having diarrhea. And you did a barium series on the dog. And at first you're like, I'm going to keep her overnight. I got to do a barium series. I'm worried about a foreign body. Of course, at that time you didn't know diagnostic ultrasound, but that's okay. You did the barium study. We went over the barium study. You looked me in the eye and you're like, all I can tell you, sir, is that your dog has a bad case of the shits. That's exactly what you told me. And I walked out of there and I took an application because I couldn't find a job anywhere in Wilmington. And after my first 6-hour shift that I had there, I knew because of the culture of the practice, because of you and Philip and Sammy and all these people, that this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And that's why you're my hero, because you changed my whole trajectory of what I was going to do. Because then the challenge became, okay, veterinary school is hard to get into. I got to start doing better in school, even though I was a swimmer and still working for you at the same time, which by the way, was not legal because I was on a full ride and the NC2A didn't allow that at the time. NIL doesn't exist at that point. So that's why you are so important to me, because like I said, when everyone asks how I can be such a cheerleader, it's because my coach was a cheerleader. You still preach the same dumb quotes and the same goddamn movies today as you did 30 years ago. Do you know how many listeners I'm going to have that's going to go have to try to find that movie by Robert Redford?
Isn't it time to end this interview?
So when you look around at this new generation, what worries you?
Oh, gosh. I don't know that I'm really worried about the new generation.
Are you worried for the profession then?
Well, when I was at Illinois, I earned the nickname the high school football coach because I was rough on them. And you probably remember that when you worked for me, I was rough on you. And, this younger generation's not used to having a high school football coach. And, everybody got participation awards. And I had one student, she started crying in the middle of surgery. And I'm like, why are you crying? And she said, you didn't compliment me on my last surgery. And it's easy to generalize, and say, well, our generation, we were tough, and you had car malts thrown at you and whatnot. But I don't know. I think that certainly they're better educated or as well educated as can be. I think they probably will succeed. They'll probably succeed because they are more in tune with, work-life balance, if that is such a thing.
No, it's called professional sustainability. I wrote an article about that. It can't be called
work. Funny because I think I may have read the same article, but I couldn't remember the name for it. But
article. I wrote it. I wrote it.
Maybe that's why I did. That's why I read it.
That's probably why you don't like it.
No, I like it. I just couldn't remember that. It's, Gersh, come on. That's like calling a garbage man a sanitation engineer. It's a balance between your work and your professional or your personal life. But in any case, that's important because look at me. I'm sitting on two divorces, because of my desire to be as successful and have as a good a quality practice as possible. And I think there'll be less of that tendency in the newer generation. So I see a lot of them they've been in practice for 4 or 5 years and they're starting to feel burnt out. And I think that, what I've already mentioned about things kind of become mundane and they need maybe new challenges, new things to excite them. But also, to some extent, I'm certainly not an expert on this, but I think that it becomes a self-perpetuating thing. You've got an associate that's been in practice 4 or 5 years. They really don't like doing surgery, but it's part of their job. So I would encourage them to think, to kind of flip the script, so to speak, instead of getting up in the morning saying, oh God, I got to do surgery today. Try, I get to do surgery today. And that small shift in perspective maybe will allow them to have new challenges and opportunities that has the potential to make it fun again.
So what's the one truth about burnout that no one's talking about?
Well, I think that's...
Because do you think when you said it wasn't fun anymore, that truly was burnout? Because it certainly sounds like it was to me.
Well, I think at the time I thought it was. And you know, I didn't feel challenged. I didn't jump out of bed in the morning saying, ah, I get to do surgery today. And I think, you know, flipping, it's like right now, the nonprofit that I'm working for, you know me, I'd rather spay cats than play golf. But they lost their wellness veterinarian, so they've asked me to do, you know, a wellness shift every week, which means I have to interact with clients, and I got to look at yucky skin and yucky ears, and, you know, I want to shoot myself in the head. But I take one for the team, and I got to the point after a couple of those shifts, I literally, you know, wanted to walk out in front of traffic. But I, as I was brushing my teeth that night, I do a lot of thinking when I brush my teeth. I'm asking myself.
Well, at least you started doing that.
At least I still have teeth to brush. you know, I ask myself, why is it that I hate wellness so much? And, you know, the pat answer is because you're a spay-neuter surgeon, you love doing surgery. But the more I thought about it, I said, you know what? I need to flip the script. I need to get up tomorrow morning and say, I get to do wellness. And it kind of has made a difference because we've had some interesting cases. And, you know, there have been days when I'm just about to hit the wall. Because, you know, I am 70 years old. I'm not a spring chicken. And, you know, being on my feet for 10 hours, it takes its toll. But Monday, was it this Monday? What's today, Friday?
Yes.
Yeah, it might have been Monday. I was doing wellness. And, you know, normally we finish up about 4 o'clock. And it was about 3:30. My last appointment was a little 4-month-old kitten that was lethargic and had been vomiting. And this skinny little thing. And so I took an abdominal radiograph, and there's a bell from that's missing from the cat's collar stuck in its small intestine.
You get to do surgery.
And I get to do surgery. And I said to the head tech, I said, all right, go prep the OR. She goes, you know, it's now 4 o'clock. We're supposed to be leaving and it's going to be a late recovery. And she goes, we're not going to do it tonight, are we? And I said, yeah, if we don't do it tonight, this cat may not be alive tomorrow. And long story short, you know, it took me maybe 15 minutes to do that enterotomy. Cat woke up great. The next day it's eaten, no vomiting, you know, and so. It was all about perspective because, you know, had I not done that surgery, that kitten would have died. But what's interesting is the staff, once I pulled the bell out, closed the bowel and, you know, finished the surgery, and they saw the cat waking up, I think the staff realized that too and said, you know what, we just saved this kitten's life.
Yeah, because you also have to worry about zinc toxicity too from those bells.
What toxicity?
Zinc. Because then you'll get the hemolytic anemia from it.
Yeah, you're right.
So that's absolutely why you got to get in and get that bell out. Yeah. Never let the sun set in a pyometra, as you told me.
Yeah.
And now I just taught you, never let the bell sit in the belly overnight.
Well, that's good advice.
Yeah.
That's good advice.
Have you ever doubted your compassion?
I don't think so. You know, for the most part, no. I think that there have been times that I've been mentally tired, maybe even exhausted, and just wanted the day to be over. And like this last Monday is a good example. This little kitty with the bell. You know, I just wanted to go home and drink a beer. But all of a sudden, here it was in my lap, you know. So that kind of re-energized me. So, yeah, I really don't think I've doubted my compassion.
Well, that's good. So when you're looking at your legacy, what do you want people to remember you by? Other than the guy that wants to go home and drink a beer, other than the guy that can be a little gruff, other than the guy that likes to throw car malts at, you know, underage children.
Actually, Gersh, we haven't actually been together and certainly haven't worked together in 25 years.
Right.
I'm not nearly as gruff as I used to be. I know you don't believe that.
I'm going to call bullshit on that now, because you can take the boy out of Wilmington, but you can't take the Wilmington out of the boy. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I really am. I'm a much more, mellow person.
Do you believe fuck's a medical term? Yes. I heard that out of your mouth a lot.
All right. So my legacy, my very first public speaking engagement was at Tuskegee University in October of 2008. I'd finished my MPH and I was volunteering with the Global Alliance for Rabies Control. And they sent me to Tuskegee to do a presentation on rabies in private practice, because this was after the Johnny the puppy incident. So the next morning I got up, I was staying at the University of Union. I got up and I ran around campus to see all the history. Have you ever been to Tuskegee? You really need to go, because the place is...
No, I haven't yet. I have not been to Tuskegee yet, but I would love to go. I've interviewed a few veterinarians that went there, and they talk about just the legacy and the history of the school. Oh,
yeah. So here's what happened. As I'm coming back to the Union, I came upon a small cemetery. And I thought, well, you know, I'll go see what's in the cemetery, you know. Bizarre.
Because everyone thinks the same.
You know, in there were two of the most famous men in Black history, arguably in all of history, Booker T. Washington and George Washington Carver. And their graves were kind of opposite one another. And Carver's grave didn't have a headstone. It had just a concrete sarcophagus over the whole grave. And there was an inscription on it that has resonated with me to this day. It said, "He could have sought fame and fortune, wanting neither. He chose simply to make the world a better place for his fellow man." And it was like God himself spoke to me in that moment. And that set me on my course for where I am today. And I honestly, I want that to be my legacy. I want to be remembered not for throwing car malts, but for making the world a better place for my fellow man.
Yeah. Well, you'll be amazed how many veterinarians that you've taught and trained that probably still, like I said, carry on the things that you have taught them. Whether it be University of Illinois, whether it be associates that work, or, you know, assistants that work for you in Wilmington, associates that work for you in Wilmington. Even this past Monday when you took the bell out of the kitten, all those people working there will never forget that. They won't. So you are making it a better place, even though you probably take the road less traveled most of the time, like me. You are a man of many, many opinions and very few filters, which is another thing I got from you.
I got more filters now, but you know, it's funny, because talking about making an impact on people you work with, I had just started working. This is right after I moved to Florida and got my Florida veterinary license. I'd started working at a nonprofit, just doing spay neuter, Staff didn't know me. I didn't know them. So we were in that courtship period, so to speak. So, you know, I enjoyed it. I mean, you know, why play golf when you can spay cats?
Oh, man.
One day I was spaying this little dog, a little cute little fuzzy thing, but she wasn't oxygenating well. And when I was done with the spay, her pulse ox wouldn't get above low 80s. So I got a stethoscope and ausculted her chest, and man, I think this dog's got a pneumothorax. And so I got a butterfly catheter, three-way stock cock with syringe, and I tapped her chest, and sure enough, she had free air. Well, the head tech had never seen anything like this, so she called the ED, said, "You better get over here. He's doing something I've never seen before." And it turns out the dog did have a diaphragmatic hernia, and from previously being hit by a car. The owner, of course, neglected to give us that information in the history. Oh, yeah, she was hit by a car 6 months ago. But we saved her life. And I'm still working with two of the staff members at a new nonprofit now. And they will, from time to time, bring that story up, including the head tech, who I think her nose was a little out of joint that I was doing that. And she didn't have a clue why, I didn't understand, and wanted the ED to come over. And then when we got all the air out and the pulse ox was back up in the high 90s, and we were able to get a radiograph and see that there was indeed a diaphragmatic hernia, and then go ahead and, you know, repair that and save the dog's life, I think that made a lasting impression on her. You know, she was one of the ones helping me with the bell, and she's the one that said, "We're going to do this now." And I said, "Yeah, we're going to do it now."
Yes.
And then, but at the end of that, I think she saw the value in doing it. So yeah, maybe so. Who knows?
After all your years of service, and I ask this of everybody, what is one irreplaceable truth that you've learned about the profession?
Well, you see, you don't believe me when I say that I'm a kinder, gentler Bob, right? You think I'm bullshitting you. One of the things you don't know about me is that I have become a student of Stoic philosophy. I don't know if you're familiar with what Stoic philosophy is, but the single most important practice in Stoic philosophy is differentiating between what we can change and what we can't. What we have influence over and what we don't. So it is really how we react to things that are beyond our control that determines our attitude and outlook. And one of my favorite quotes is from an individual by the name of Charles Swindoll, says, "I'm convinced that life is 10% what happens to me and 90% what I make of it." So I really, you know, the other day I was riding my motorcycle to work, and the train, you know, arms came down. I knew I was going to be stuck in traffic. The old Bob would have pitched a fit, you know, there would have been swear words and yeah. The new Bob just cut the bike off, and yeah, I looked at my phone and I thought, well, I'll catch up on the news or something, you know, because I realized I had no control over the fact that train was crossing in front of me and was going to delay me, and, you know, gave me a chance to catch up on the news. another of the tenets of Stoic philosophy, and we've already talked about this, but this kind of defines me, is a good life is a life of virtue. In other words, the path to true happiness is not the selfish pursuit of pleasure. That would be the old Bob. But a values-driven life of integrity, ethical behavior, and service. That, my friend, is an irreplaceable truth.
Okay, I just got to let my audience know he was never this deep when we got when I was working with him. But I guess when you do move down to Florida and you just spay cats and enjoy good weather year round, that's what happens.
Well,
But I mean, I just want the listeners to realize, just, you know, when I say, when I always bring you up and talk about this, and I was thinking of all these things as you were talking, when it comes to a mentor, this guy not only moved me to Illinois, he also was a groomsman in my wedding. He also signed my ketubah at my wedding that is still hanging on my wall. He was the first person to meet my girlfriend, or the woman I ended up marrying at the time. And he's always been there on the phone no matter when I've called him. So I pray and I hope that everyone can find someone like this in the profession to help guide them. And I would say that is probably my irreplaceable truth. Because if it wasn't for this guy, if he would have crashed in that plane or not been part of my legacy that I started back in Wilmington, I would not be where I am today. And Bob, I can't thank you enough. Between you and Coach Dave Allen, my swim coach there, there is a reason in the universe that things happen. And I can't thank you enough.
Well, Gersh, you're nice to say that. I think you're overselling it a bit, but
No, I'm not.
I appreciate it. I mean,
let someone blow smoke up your ass for once and not be a smart ass about it. How's that?
Can I leave your viewers with one parting thought?
What's that?
And it's serious. It's not a.
Oh, okay. It's not a Bobism. Okay, no, we're good.
Well, I just, you know, I we've talked a lot about burnout and challenges in the profession, and I would encourage your listeners. I imagine you're going to show this on LinkedIn, right? So
I'll try to give it to the world.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, if they have questions, they're welcome to contact me, but I don't know that, I want to find my phone number on a John Wall in a bar downtown, wherever, but, I would encourage them to find their ikigai. And for those of you that are not familiar with the Japanese concept of ikigai, literally translated, it means your reason for being. And this has really helped me in terms of my approach to my professional life. And one of the reasons that I really truly would rather spay cats than play golf, because there are four components to ikigai. Do you love what you do? And I think that speaks for itself, because, you know, days that I have surgery, I bound out of bed at 4 a.m, like, I get to do surgery today. Are you good at it? That's the second component. Well, I wrote 2 chapters in the textbook, so, you know, I must know what I'm talking about. But the most important part of ikigai is the third component, and that is, does it benefit the community? And for me, that is the overarching reason that I do spay neuter, is because it benefits the community. And finally, the fourth component is, can you get paid for it? Well, you know, I guess I can use a little beer money now and then, but, so those are the four, components of ikigai. And there have been times in my professional career, that I've lost my ikigai. And, you know, I've learned new things, which then leads to new challenges. And that's helped me rediscover my ikigai. So if the people who are listening to this, I've got a really great link to, the article that introduced me to the concept of ikigai. And it's worth reading, because, if you don't have, a reason for being, you're just going to flounder. And I think that that may contribute to some of the burnout stuff that we talked about earlier. In any case, here endeth the morning lesson.
Well, Professor Bob Whedon, I can't thank you enough. I think Ikigai translated for me in English would be fulfillment. And I think finding your fulfillment is very important. I think having integrity with what you do is very important. And I think paying it forward with whatever you've learned is also very important. So, Bob, I can't thank you for being on. I am definitely going to get you on again. I think we should do a roast podcast together where you and I just go after each other after all the crap that we know about each other. And with that, Bob, thanks for being on. If you have any questions for Bob Whedon, you can find him on LinkedIn. If you have any questions and you want me to ask him because you're just too afraid because you don't want a car molt throwing at you, you can hit me up on any of the socials as well. And we'll talk to you all next time. Bob, thank you so much for being here. It meant the world to me.
Gersh, thank you for having me. And I hope I didn't embarrass you too much.
No, I'm trying to get you this time. Talk to you all later.
All right, see you.